Welcome to City of God, a podcast of the Center for Public Theology at Midwestern Baptist Theological Seminary. My name is Dr. Owen Strand, and I'll be your host. Join us each week as we engage the city of man with the biblical wisdom of the city of God. What is the freedom that America is based on? In the book First Freedom, The Beginning and End of Religious Liberty, editors Jason Dusing, Thomas White, and Malcolm Yarnell make the case that the very foundation of all liberty that we enjoy in America in the 21st century is our first freedom, religious liberty. Joining me today is Jason Dusing, provost at Midwestern Baptist Theological Seminary, and as I say, one of the co-editors of the book. Dr. Dusing, welcome to the podcast.
Well, thanks so much for having me. It's a joy to be here.
I'm wondering if, as we begin our conversation today, you could just recap how this book came to be, First Freedom, just out in 2016.
Well, it originally started as a conference on the campus of Southwestern Seminary in Fort Worth, Texas in 2005, where me and my two colleagues had been given the opportunity to put together a conference to explore some aspect of what we call Baptist distinctives. And through the counsel of our president there, we went to the direction of exploring themes related to religious liberty. And thankfully, our friends at B&H Academic saw fit to put it together in a book that came out in 2007. Well, since that time, the book was well received and read by many people, but intentionally it was dated in terms of its material. It was addressing 2007 concerns. And with the increasingly ratcheting up of pressures related to this theme in this country, especially related to this election year, B&H Academic was kind to let us re-release it, and it has over 50% new content directed to the contemporary experiment. And we also changed the theme, overall theme, a little bit. The new subtitle is The Beginning and End of Religious Liberty, really trying to draw home to this idea of why is religious liberty important and really what happens if it comes to an end.
Yeah, religious liberty has been in the headlines for some time now. As you say, you know, 10 years ago, we were thinking about this issue, but it's especially imperiled today, a major matter of concern for many of us in the church. What is it about religious liberty in particular that is so dramatically important? In other words, if we lose this freedom, what imperils other freedoms in that loss?
Well, it's, you know, rightly called the first freedom in the sense that it's the preserver of all other freedoms. And it's a recognition. The historical section of the book explores how some of early evangelicals and Baptists really saw, I think, had a lot of foresight in seeing in the need for separation of church and state, really sort of identifying the fact that the state has no power over men's souls, their right to regulate and provide restrictions on what men can do to one another physically in terms of laws and civil powers and things like that, but they really have no jurisdiction over men's souls. And as many of these early forefathers sort of almost cheekily said that if the government wants to answer for those individuals to God in heaven, then they should. But since they can't, they have no business regulating those things. So it's a recognition of sort of rightly ordering the protection of men's and their relationship to their Creator. And from a Christian perspective, it's also a recognition that that Christianity is never meant to be coerced or forced. Never in the New Testament do you see anyone – you see people using persuasive language and even pleading, but it's not a recognition that it can ever be coerced or forced. And so as Christians, we want to create a society in which people have the freedom to pursue whatever religious tradition they feel compelled to pursue within their own hearts, knowing that Christianity itself, because it is not something that can be coerced, will survive and thrive in that context.
That's an excellent point. There's a lot of interest today in retrieving theology. It's often called retrieval theology in the evangelical or religious academy. And you and I like to talk about the Reformation, but not simply the folks that many Christians think of, Luther, Calvin, Zwingli, and others, and we're very thankful for those names and many others, John Knox and Puritans, we're deeply thankful for them. But you and I and many others and the authors of this book, the contributors, are also thankful for a somewhat less popular strand of the Reformation, the radical reformers, the Anabaptists. There are some interesting elements in the Anabaptist movement. We can be very plain and upfront about that. But the Anabaptists really do promote this doctrine that you're writing about in this important book. Can you talk to us about the Anabaptist connection here?
Well, the Anabaptists are largely unknown, especially in an academic setting in which we have the privilege of serving here, in that those who, in most academic settings, those who teach church history think the Anabaptists will be covered in a more confessional, denominational type class, and then those mm-hmm. who teach the Baptist studies classes think that the Anabaptists might be covered in the church history classes, and so they're largely overlooked. That's mm-hmm. a generous way of looking at it sometimes, but rightly so. As George Hunston Williams, the old Harvard scholar, in his really preeminent book on the Radical Reformation, helped to identify. Mm. There are more than one streams of Anabaptists, and he particularly zeroed in on what we would call the evangelical stream of Anabaptists that showed broad continuity with the rest of the Reformation in terms of most doctrines. They're just pursuing ecclesiology, and the separation of church and state is the thing that's identifying them as separate. But those individuals, although small in number and did not live long, really saw this idea of the pursuit of religious freedom as sort of a cardinal trait. And I think it's the one thing that really welcomes them in our own day, or provides mm-hmm. them to be beneficial. So if you think about the transmission history of the Anabaptists in the 20th century, most historians would see them as ugly stepchildren that they want nothing to do with, or noisy nuisances that they would rather push aside or sort of drowned out. But what I hope we're trying to show in this book is that finally, perhaps the Anabaptists have come full circle. Instead of sounding cacophonous, they might actually sound symphonious to many of us as we're looking through the roots and foundations of this idea of religious freedom.
Mm, very nicely said. You could almost say that the Anabaptists, though scorned in the 16th century and in some cases murdered, drowned, burned at the stake even, which is a grim reality in churches. In church history. But if you look at them today, you can almost say that they have triumphed, as you say. We're kind of saying the same thing here. I'm just reinforcing what you've just laid out. But, I mean, there are very few people today who are going to make the case in public theology or even just political philosophy, for example, that the state should in some way oversee the church, that the magistrates of Geneva, for example, in the 16th century should, you know, be kind of helping the church to oversee church membership. Almost nobody's making that case. Anywhere, secular or Christian, and so it really is interesting to think about how the Anabaptists' day seems to be now.
Well, I think they had a lot of foresight, and again, their lives were not lived long enough to really play this out, but I think they saw and really had in mind future generations and not just their own. Hmm. The Reformation and all of its wonders was miraculous, and how grateful we are for the recovery of the gospel in that time. Hmm. But until you have a full Reformation in terms of ecclesiology, you're only recovering that gospel for at least a generation. There's nothing in the purity of the church to ensure that that gospel will be transmitted to future generations. So the Anabaptist pursuit of a purer ecclesiology was not just majoring on the minors or on less essential doctrines, but I think it was actually more prophetic, saying we're trying to preserve the health of the church separate from the state, so that this gospel that we are now treasuring and prizing can be there for great-grandchildren, and then even one day seeing it transmitted to the ends of the earth.
Mm, that's beautifully said. Part of what I see taking place among some scholars and theologians today is a regaining of confidence in the Baptist tradition. I think there's been a lot of energy given to recovering Protestantism, Reformational theology, and a lot of us appreciate elements of that. But part of what we're seeing, I think, among the younger generation is that folks like you and me have the privilege of introducing them to figures like the Anabaptist, figures like Carl Henry, figures like Charles Spurgeon, who really show the younger generation that they don't need to be ashamed or shy about being a full-fledged Baptist, first and foremost because of the scriptures. But then when you go to church history, when you go to historical theology, there are some major contributions that are made that show us that young Baptists should not have their heads hanging when they're in a big crowd of Christians. They should, in fact, be very thankful for their heritage.
I couldn't agree more, and of course it's something we talk a lot about with students, is that they belong to right now, whether they realize it or not, some sort of confessional tradition, some sort of stream of Christianity. They belong to that. One metaphor that I use is that there are many solid gospel-centered ships on this sea of evangelicalism, and many of them are healthily pointed in a Great Commission direction. We're all sailing together. Hmm. And so it becomes a point at which, what ship are you on? You're on one. Or maybe even to put it a different way, on what ship has God placed you? And if he's placed you on a ship, then it's a matter of doing all you can within that tradition to help it become more efficient and effective and healthy to help it to sail faster and more stronger in that Great Commission direction. And if you're not comfortable on that ship, well, it's, you know, you need to go find one you can be comfortable on. But the fact is that everyone will be on a stream or tradition, even if it's a nameless tradition of one stripe or the other. And so to make the case of the Baptist tradition is not one that's bigger and better or stronger or more powerful. There's a lot of faults and foibles to be had in the history of the Baptist, especially among our own particular denomination in its beginnings with its ties to slavery and things like this.
That's right.
But that doesn't mean that those things have no value for the future. And if God's placed you in one of those traditions, it's every bit worth your while to embrace it, to do your part to strengthen it and to make it more healthy.
I saw a church leader on Twitter recently say, in a moment of sort of humorous frustration, "Is anyone besides younger Baptists working on public theology these days?" And it is exciting. There are many people in many different streams, many ships, to use your metaphor of just a minute ago, who are working on these public concerns. But it's really terrific to see you and peers of ours working on this major issue of religious liberty. Before we close, could you just lay out for us an example you see that has your attention of how religious liberty is challenged today so that listeners can be thinking about such an example?
Well, we see it popping up in a variety of settings, both on the national and state level. And of course, a lot of the things that you talk about in this space and in your own writings at the Center for Public Theology related to sexual orientation and gender identity laws and how that can easily become an infringement upon a church's religious liberty or an individual's religious liberty. Those are all areas, and our friends at the Alliance Defending Freedom are a wonderful resource, as well as our friends at the Ethics and Religious Liberty Commission, in terms of identifying those. And so with every passing day, there's some new situation and also some new report on an existing situation. So all of those are prevalent cases in our own day and time to kind of watch. And another area you could explore is how it relates to the expression of religious freedom within Christian higher education. And there's a chapter in the book that looks specifically at that, Dr. White's chapter.
Yeah, it's funny because you actually see in the public square religious liberty now when it's reported on in leading spaces, you know, the New York Times, Washington Post, putting religious liberty as a phrase in quotation marks as if it's something that doesn't exist, only as a fiction in the minds of these overheated evangelicals, when in reality, as this book clearly shows, it is the first freedom of America. So we're in a day and an age that is not very friendly, increasingly, towards this concept of religious liberty. But as you have said plainly in the book and in this this session, this is a matter that Christians need to be engaged in. We need to defend religious liberty and pray about its preservation.
And I can just say, I guess in closing too, is that sometimes this comes across as sort of self-preserving, that we're trying to create space for our own existence. But actually, the reverse is the case. We're, as Christians, should stand confidently and know that our hope is ultimately in the day when religious liberty comes to an end. That's the whole point of Philippians 2, that at one point, when Jesus returns, every knee will bow and every tongue will confess, and there will be no more time for the expression of religious faith as one so chooses. Everyone will acknowledge. It's not universalism, but it is universal acknowledgement that Jesus is Lord. And so as Christians, we're seeking to preserve this freedom of religion while there's still time so that people can taste and see that the Lord is good and repent and turn to Jesus Christ. So it's actually very other-centered rather than just preserving our own rights and freedoms.
That's very well said. The Lord of the harvest is returning. It's interesting to think about how Christianity actually has created a space historically in these different societies for people of different religions to thrive and flourish. Of course, our ultimate goal is not simply diversity for its own sake, but as you say, for gospel proclamation and reception. So very well said. Well, thank you so much, Dr. Dusing, for being on City of God on this podcast. And we wish this book, First Freedom, every good blessing. May it go far and wide.
Thank you so much.
Thanks for listening to City of God, a podcast at the Center for Public Theology at Midwestern Baptist Theological Seminary. We're so thankful you stopped by. We encourage you to continue to join the conversation at cpt.mbts.edu, the official website of the center. And we encourage you to follow us on Twitter and Facebook as well. Join us in coming days as we continue the conversation on what it means to be the city of God in the city of man.